Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 135. I'm Chris, and with me today is
Matt
and
Sean.
Dr. Sean. He's finally back from his grand world tour, proving how smart he is to everybody else. And I'm just kidding, but it's a good time for Sean to come back because Sean is an automotive engineering expert. Part of the reason we have him on our panel of Gizmo Sapiens. And today we're going to talk about the automobile and its current state of affairs, and particularly leaning towards the electric, you know, the future of electric automobile engineering. And Sean and I had a conversation, I don't know, 3-4 weeks ago, and you said something that kind of stuck with me, and I was just curious about the thought and logic behind it. But you basically said that you think we're going in the, at least in the short term, you think we're going in the wrong direction, and that we should take the more European model and go with small turbocharged diesel cars or diesel engines in vehicles as opposed to going electric. And it obviously would solve several things. The fuel industry would not have to change. The legislation around automobiles and taxation and things like that would not have to change, particularly road taxes, which I've been preaching, what, for 2 or 3 years now? About, you know, with the move to electric, you know, they're going to have to address road taxes. And so what does Ohio do? We jump road taxes for gas for 10 cents a gallon and 17 for diesel. To cover the fact that there's actually starting to be a significant number of electric vehicles on the road.
But the other thing Ohio did with that legislation was include a registration fee for hybrids and electric vehicles. So they're not going to contribute to.
Yeah, but I mean, you always had to register your car.
Sort of.
So
yeah, but it's going to cost you an extra $100 or whatever it is if you have a hybrid or an electric.
Okay, cost me an extra $100. Every time I fill the tank up on my truck, I'm paying.
I'm not saying it's a significant contribution. I'm saying this is what Ohio does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's they think that that's a major contribution. Once again, the General Assembly has made decisions that make sense in Columbus, but the rest of the state's just shaking our head.
Interesting. So let's go back to what Sean was talking about. So lay it out, Dr. Sean.
So one of the things, and this is kind of more of a European model, is they've gone smaller vehicles, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And historically, that has worked for them in terms of lifestyle. It's worked for them in terms of fuel consumption and so on. You know, gasoline and refinement is imports for Europe, so they've always had a higher rate. Japan, same way, and so on. The U.S. and, you know, the Middle East in here, but the U.S. has done its own refining, so essentially gasoline prices, if you compare worldwide, have always been very, very inexpensive in the United States. The cost, not prices. Prices, you know, go back to taxes, what we just talked about and stuff. So anyways, so diesel is very interesting, and diesel has gone a couple different ways in the United States historically. You have the agricultural diesel that was heavily subsidized, and you're not allowed to use that in recreational vehicles.
Well, essentially, you don't pay the road tax.
You don't pay the road tax, right? And then you have your other, you know, regular diesel. But diesel got a bad name historically in the United States because it was not clean burning. It was terrible for the environment and so on, and even I have to agree mostly on that. Nowadays, with the ultra-low sulfur diesel, it that's not even an issue. It's a very clean burning fossil fuel. It is readily available. Will it run out at some point? Yeah, probably. You know, we can discuss that at a different time. But diesel technology and diesel engines have been around for 130, 140 years. And it's a very efficient, a lot more efficient than a gasoline engine in terms of combustion, okay? In terms of waste products given off and so on. So European car makers have upped the ante by making their diesel engines a lot more efficient and so on. So you get back to the United States and you say, well, that's not going to work in the United States because you, in Europe, those smaller vehicles work well on European roads, but when you get in the United States, you have more open roads, you know, so on and so forth. Adding the, and what Europe did is add the turbocharger technology to that, you get by with a smaller engine for the same amount of torque and horsepower. So, and the torque is kind of where the people are going to feel it anyways. So you have that, you have the environmental issue and so on, and that makes diesel a very good choice. Now, flip that over, why is it probably a better choice than electric? Electric cars today, we still don't have the infrastructure, and we won't for a long period of time, and nobody's talking about that. You know, electric car technology is there. People are not buying them. You know, they are buying some, but it's not a very viable cost model. Infrastructure-wise, again, we don't have a lot of that. It's just not something that people are going to switch over to unless they're forced to. And then you get into, you know, social engineering and so on. You force people to do that. And the last one I'm gonna kind of throw out there is, okay, so I'm an environmentalist. I want to hug a polar bear and so on. So I'm going to go electric over diesel because you just mentioned the dirty word, fossil fuels. Biodiesel is a very, very easy conversion, if any, on most of the vehicles, and biodiesel is readily available. Biodiesel can be produced a lot more inexpensively than ethanol. Biodiesel takes care of some of the products in our waste stream currently, and yet nobody is pushing that. Where you kind of may see that in the future is freight vehicles, but it's just not being pushed forth. At UD, we were talking about this a couple weeks ago. It was changing our fleet over, and everybody wants to change the fleet over to all electric cars, which I'm okay with electric cars. Most of our fleet, they don't go more than 10 miles away from campus, so it doesn't really matter for that. But then we have, our trucks and vans, and we're talking about using diesel and then possibly figuring out how to do biodiesel. Here's the problem. Nowhere in the Dayton area is there a commercial source for biodiesel. So right now it doesn't fit the commercial model. But so I guess my point is, with engine technology where it's at today and where it's something that we know about and we can make it more efficient, it makes it a better engine, we can do the environmental thing and so on. We can kind of satisfy both sides of the argument by going in that route, and that's kind of the route I want to see people kind of follow.
So, I mean, you kind of mentioned the whole biodiesel issue, of it, which is very similar in that perspective to the lack of electric car infrastructure,
right?
Which is it's kind of weird because it's like overnight electric car infrastructure started showing up, and it's not where you thought it was, which is a direct challenge to the oil industry, or oil and gasoline industry, I should say. Today, you know, a good example is around here we have Dorothy Lane Market, which is a local grocery store chain. They've installed two Tesla superchargers, and then there's four other EV, standard EV chargers at all their stores. There's an app called, let me see if I can find it on my phone. But there's an app out there, and there's probably multiple apps, but this one I just happened to find, that lists all of the EV stations in your area. And so I looked at it, and I was impressed by how much infrastructure is there. Now, the problem is none of it's on, like, the Myers, they're up off of 70 towards, as you go out towards Brookville, they have 8 EV charging stations. 4 of them are Tesla, but it's not a gas station, you know? And so, you know, I think there's that disconnect because gas stations haven't switched over, and they're generally put in places where we have long distance travel. And that is one of the differences between the United States and Europe. They have long distance travel.
Okay, so infrastructure is not just charging stations though, but that's a huge part of it. Hybrid breaks down, where do you take it?
Well, exactly. They don't have the parts, the service and the parts distribution. And I mean, that it's a huge, huge. The issue is not so much technology, it's supply chain at this point. That's Tesla's problem right now, is supply chain.
Plus, those vehicles are not made to go across Ohio roads. I mean, Ohio, you need a four-wheel drive to go across I-75.
Yeah.
And those vehicles, you lose them. The batteries are not meant to jostle between, you know, in terms of feet, right? So.
True.
So the other thing about biodiesel, though, is you can put a biodiesel reactor localized and you wouldn't have to ship gasoline. I mean, where's your refineries at, right? Your refineries are Detroit area and Texas and, you know,
New Jersey,
and you got to ship all that crap, you know. You can put a biodiesel reactor pretty much anywhere within reason, and people won't even notice it's there. Mm-hmm. You can localize that too, and that's now, infrastructure too.
I mean, I've read a lot about biodiesel. And people who build their own reactor to...
Yeah, Sinclair has a course on it, and they have their own reactor on their campus.
And all of that. But what changes would a diesel engine have to have to
very
run
little,
like?
Very little. In fact, most of the modern engines with the chip control that they have will do its own adapt. It's basically changing on timing. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. And the driver won't even have to do anything.
So how does flex fuel fit into all of this?
So flex fuel is actually a chip that determines, it senses which fuel you're running, and it changes its timing. Again, independent of the driver. So it would be similar to that.
Okay.
But there's no mechanical changes to an engine to change from diesel to biodiesel.
Okay. And for those of you who don't know, flex fuel is it's an ethanol alcohol made from corn alternative.
It's the world's worst use of alcohol. I mean, if you're going to do something with alcohol, you make bourbon out of it, don't make fuel out of it.
Yeah. But if you're out drinking one night and have a bottle of bourbon,
you can put it in your vehicle and run it.
Yeah. But so without those changes, maybe exhaust would be more pleasant because it would smell like French fries.
It does. So at Sinclair, they run some of their maintenance vehicles, and it does smell like a McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
Going behind it. And what's really funny is, you know, 10 years ago when they were playing around with this, people would give you their waste because it's, I mean, you can run with... Within reason, you could run like pure vegetable oil in a diesel engine and it'll run. It won't run well, but it'll run, right? Mm-hmm. Well, people were giving away their waste until they figured out what people are doing with it. Now they sell it. So they're selling their, you know, shit fryer oil for a profit. And basically, it's just garbage. I mean, what do? You can't clean it and reuse it, right?
So, mm-hmm.
It makes a very interesting dynamic in terms of money. And again, I mean, there's a ton of waste, bio waste out there. I mean, and there always will be.
Yeah.
It's not something that's going away. So why not use it?
Oh, I don't disagree. I don't disagree.
No, yeah.
I mean, I always thought, so one of the things that I think is strange, and Tesla did address it, but I always said that the reality of electric vehicles is that they're never going to really take off until commercial vehicles turn into it. Because that's really, yeah, we run millions of miles, people in their cars across the nation every year. But the reality it is that's a drop in the bucket compared to commercial trucking and things like that. And that's, I've always thought that You mentioned that, you know, the whole idea of the trucks and vans and things, the bigger vehicles would run off biodiesel, make a lot more sense than electric. And I agree with that. I own a farm. I have two pickup trucks. I own six tractors, two of which are diesel. Mm-hmm. And electric does not make sense because, you know, I can't. Electric motors are great. They have a lot of torque on the low, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. They have all the torque that they're ever going to have
on the low end.
And so they're great for those kind of applications. But, you know, the idea of maintenance and running it and things, you know, in a farming environment, I think is prohibitive. Mm-hmm. Although there is a company out there who's now developing half-ton electric vehicles for that industry.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting because how are they going to really fare against Ford and General Motors?
If you take a turbocharged Jetta versus a Chevy Bolt, I don't know the exact numbers, but the Jetta weighs a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the weight problem. So it's we dictate laws before we dictate technology and common sense. And the problem is twofold. One is the government obviously stepping in where it doesn't know what it's doing. But the other problem is a lot of the car companies do try to screw over, and they have an agenda also. And so when you listen to like General Motors speak, you always listen to, oh crap, are they lying to us? Because half the time they probably are. They're trying to make a profit. Yeah. You almost have to figure out, is there an independent way of dictating laws based upon technology, but not based upon the commercial part of it, and not letting that taint the argument? Right now, there isn't. Some parts of the world, universities fill that role. In the U.S., we don't do that. We don't independently do that research and necessarily publish it without our agenda too, you know, because we're getting money from the government to do that. So,
yeah. Well, so how does LP gas fit in? I mean, LP gas has been around forever. Matter of fact,
CNG and LP are excellent. In fact, California used to push that for. They still do this for fleet vehicles, the white van that you know used to kidnap people. Right? CNG is huge. Well, it is. So CNG is huge for those. Very, very clean burning. Very inexpensive. What I was talking to a person just a couple days ago in California about this. It's odd that California was one of the ones that pushed it, but the Midwest never grasped it, considering the Midwest has huge amounts of natural gas to basically sell. You don't have to go to Saudi Arabia.
Well, heck, look at the giant pipeline that runs through all of Ohio.
Yeah. So very, very popular. I'm sorry. Very viable, but not very popular. I would like to see that kind of come back, but right now with infrastructure, it's people can't afford to go electric and CNG and fill in the mm-hmm. blank.
The thing is, there is industrial vehicles and farm vehicles. I mean, ever since the 50s, mm-hmm. almost every Ford tractor made had a LP gas option. You could either get it in gas, diesel, or LP gas.
Right.
Almost all, it's probably split 50-50. But like forklifts that are used across the United States, they're either LP gas or they're electric. And most people use LP gas because it's easier to deal with. They don't have to plug them in. And a lot of the places that have LP gas, like a good example is Tractor Supply. They have a forklift that they use to unload all the trucks and to move large items, you know, into customer vehicles and things like that. And so they have an LP gas forklift.
Right.
But they also sell gas. You know, they refill your propane tank for your gas grill.
Right.
And so they have another source of LP gas right on site too, if they need to fill that back up.
Well, on larger vehicles, the argument has been, you know, LP and CNG has less energy content than gasoline. Gasoline's the best. And so everybody's trying to get to gasoline in terms of energy content. You know, there's a reason why gasoline is popular, and it's not because we sold our soul to the Saudis. That's not exactly the case. There's actually an engineering and science benefit to gasoline, and so.
But then we go into you can get into that though. You know, carburation versus fuel injection. Like General Motors had a V8, carbureted V8 back in the 60s that would do 80 miles plus per gallon.
Oh, yeah.
And yet today we struggle to get 40 miles to get the gallon in modern vehicles.
Because there's a lot of other stuff added to the vehicles and, there's not a lot of money in it. There's no advantage to General Motors to put that. I mean, they're in the labs right now. You could probably walk into Detroit, into their proving grounds, and find vehicles that are 60, 70 miles per gallon engines, but they're not commercially viable. So that's, I wish we would put that money into that. The problem is, again, the government dictates based upon certain things, thou shalt do this and thou shalt do that.
Yeah.
And that's the direction we're going now.
Yeah. Well, what's your thoughts on, because, we started off talking about the European model, and for the most part, what they consider a full-size car is what we consider a compact.
True.
And so how does that, we reconcile that, particularly in today's world where companies like Ford are getting, other than building a sports car, they're getting out of the car, the standard automobile subcompact. They're going to sell sports and sport utility vehicles and a sports car, and that's it.
Because it's profit margin. If I sell a Ford, whatever their little car,
Fiesta, Focus,
or sports or whatever, they don't make profits on
them. No, they don't.
So they're getting out of it. And they also know where's industry going to go. For those smaller vehicles, it's going electric, and the next step is autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Well, and there's other market forces too. We talked about, millennials are not buying vehicles, or they're, even if they have a vehicle, they're single vehicle households. We're almost back to pre-World War II, in that concept. So not as many vehicles are being sold and things like that.
And they last longer.
Yeah.
If I build a vehicle that I give you a 10-year warranty, guess what? I've tested it for 15 years.
Yeah.
Right? So they're not flipping them.
So that also, so we see states starting to mandate things. And they haven't mandated vehicles yet, but I see it coming because we've done it in the past with the whole e-check and all of that, which was nonsense. But like California in Berkeley, they just banned no new construction with natural gas. San Francisco is starting to go down that same path. When are they going to go, no new vehicles with internal combustion engines? And how is that going to change the industry? Because it's not only, I look at it from the two, no new vehicles with internal combustion engine, right. But most people don't buy new vehicles. Most people buy used vehicles.
Right.
And so what is that going to do, when we finally hit that point? There's going to be a tipping point where we have to see, what are we going to do with all these old internal combustion vehicles?
See, I don't think in the United States that will. I think that argument, I'm trying to look up something while we're talking, that argument is, Great Britain. By 2040, no new diesel or gasoline vehicles, right? It's kind of like the gun argument. People are going to fight for their right to keep an automobile, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a non-starter in the United States to go that route. And brutally honest, I mean, the engines are so efficient to these days. It's not. I mean, there's other sources, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you have, 20 million cars in China that are driving around, or India are driving around, you don't live in a freaking bubble. So why are you taking the competitive advantage of the United States, even though we don't do a lot of the manufacturing, we do some, we do a lot of the engineering.
Yeah.
You take the again, the economic advantage of the United States away by, quote, government mandate of what you call, what you're under global warming or something like that. You know? It's just, it's a non-starter. And the way our government works, I doubt if anybody would even propose that.
Oh, I don't think from a federal level we would ever see that. But I think from the more, some of the more progressive, and it's not even, I can't even say progressive states because there are no progressive states, but there are progressive cities who.
Well, California trashed its economy by basically mandating the manufacturer of automobiles be, you know, certain. And so they lost a buttload of manufacturing in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And they're paying the price now. Of course, unemployment rate.
Yeah.
At right now. And so that's the risk they took, and that's what they wanted to do. And they're, you know, supposedly they're happy with it, but
mm-hmm.
your Ohio's and Michigan's are not going to do that.
No, I don't think so.
Texas is not going to do that. Louisiana, I mean, they still make automobiles.
Well, and outside of the coasts, we still have a significant car culture here in the United States, right. You know, and you know, there was a movie made in the early 80s where, now, that was based on because of the scare of the oil crisis in the 70s, where everybody had switched to riding bikes and all this other stuff because, you know, there was no oil economy and all this. They found this guy, and he had to go and he had a stockpile of gasoline, which is kind of interesting to think about because gasoline goes bad over time. And so he was, you know, driving his Trans Am all over the country, and they sent an aircraft after him, which the government had to pull, you know, fuel out of storage because, you know, to go after him. But it was an interesting concept from the thought of, so what happens? And I still think of that to this day because, you know, as we transition to other technologies, which is going to happen. I mean, change. We always say that there are two things that never change, and that's death and taxes, but there's actually a third one, and that is change. There's always going to be change of some kind. But, you know, when you have a culture, and frankly, a large country like the U.S., where public transportation, the infrastructure doesn't exist and would be even harder to put into place than moving to electric vehicles, what's going to happen when we do that transition? You know, we complain about, you know, in Europe they pay $5 a gallon or $5 a liter of gasoline, and we complain about paying $3 a gallon. But you know, it's conceivable that at some point, you know, there's going to be that tipping point where we're not going to be using, you know, as much gasoline. And so gasoline, you know, for your car particularly, because I run into this with my 65 Mustang, which I need leaded gasoline for, you know, how much are you going to pay per gallon of gas to keep your project or your hobby alive? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts, Matt? You've been quiet other than your statement about the legislation.
Well, I mean, there have been a couple of interesting things. I'm particularly drawn to the idea of having a Second Amendment for automobiles. It's a very interesting concept. I totally can see that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can too. But, you know, we always play that game too. There's driving is not a right, like the right to bear arms. It is a privilege.
Well, okay, I want to say this. It's not a right because the framers of the Constitution didn't declare
it.
But God didn't say, thou shalt have guns and no cars, or, you know.
No, I agree.
So, and, you know, I'm going to use my guns to protect my freaking cars. That's
true.
That's how I define my Second Amendment.
So there are other thing I was actually baiting you a little bit about the LP gas, because if you either have Rumpke or you have Waste Management for your,
yeah, I got Waste Management. I've got Rumpke.
So have you watched your checked your bill lately and seen the two new fees that are on there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's all because they switched to LP gas trucks.
I know.
And
which is very interesting because about 3 years ago or whenever the gas prices went up, they gave you a gas surcharge on the top of that. Mm-hmm. They never went back when the
It
went down.
They never do.
So it's just it's all bullshit fees. It's corporate.
Yeah.
It's corporate greed. It's all it is. And I don't even care. Netflix went up too, and that wasn't due to LP. I'm pissed off at them.
Yeah. But I just find it, you know, we're going green, so we're going to charge you for it. Which, I mean, that is the common.
No, in fact, DP&L just sent me a letter, you know, if you want to define all of your electricity coming from a green source here, but here's the surcharge we're going to charge you. I'm like, I don't care about the environment that much.
Yeah.
You know? Of course it's more expensive. And it's the argument that's beyond this podcast, but it's the argument of if you go totally sustainable, etc., you're going to pay more money.
Money. Oh, absolutely.
Period. So where, you know, in like cars, you know, do you want to go electric to save fossil fuels? Do you want to go electric to save the planet? Do you want to go electric to save money because you don't have to buy gasoline? Okay, those are three very different arguments, and I can shoot holes in all the arguments, but the gun that I use will be different guns.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And it comes down to that, you know, and that's why, you know, I'm not saying the diesel is the catch-all be-all. It is an option that you can do today. There's no development, and it takes care of certain aspects of those.
So kind of is the last thing I want to talk about. You guys weren't around, but many years ago, Sapiens did a podcast, and we were talking about alternative cars. And at the time, we had looked and researched all the different companies who were doing, and some of them were specialized. Like there was a company who was making electric police cars in Atlanta, around the Atlanta area, and they had sold quite a few across the United States. I think they're still around. But they had done a lot of things that, from an automobile perspective, were a law enforcement automobile perspective, were very daring because, you know, it addressed issues specific to that, like the back seat doors were suicide doors because as they were putting perpetrators in the back seat and they put their hands on their head to get it in, it was much easier to avoid hitting them, you know, on the roof of the car as they were making them get into the back of the car. And there were several innovations like that on the vehicle. It was kind of, but the one that interested me the most, and it was partly driven by Tata Motors out of India, who has an American subsidiary, and which they have an office in Cincinnati, a big office. But out of New York, they had teamed with his father and son who had created a compressed air motor.
Yeah.
And it was really intriguing, and I followed it for a while. I haven't followed it recently, but they did some interesting things like, you know, how electric vehicles regeneratively brake, so they generate electricity every time you brake when you back to the battery. Well, they were doing the same thing, except it put air pressure back in the tank so that they could run farther. And then they were using heating elements, solar-powered heating elements, to heat the air in the tank so it would create more pressure so that they could get more miles out of the gallon. But I haven't heard anything else. I didn't know if that was still something that the automotive industry was, you know, even though it was fringe then and it's probably still fringe now, was still investigating.
No, and I'm trying to look this up. It's actually a French design. So Tata Motors had one, but the French entrepreneur invented that years and years and years
ago. Yeah, and the father and son had bought the rights to it in New York, and they had made modifications to make it more efficient, essentially.
Yeah, and I can't speak too intelligently on it, but I do know one of the disadvantages of it was the conversion to the compressed air produced a buttload of heat.
Mm-hmm.
I knew they were dealing with that, and that conversion wasn't as efficient as the numbers on the paper seem to be and so on, which is why it got scrapped or eventually got resurrected by Tata, but the laws of thermodynamics scrapped it
mm-hmm.
100 years ago, whatever.
So there were five companies dealing with it, six companies. So there was MDI. They proposed a range of vehicles made up of AirPod, One Flow Air, City Flow Air, Mini Flow Air, and Multi Flow Air. I think these are the guys out of
New York. I think that's right.
Sounds right. And they got the idea. Yeah, so they were the ones who had the implementation of the active chamber, which is a compartment which heats the air through the use of a fuel in order to double the energy output. That's how they were getting around that issue with the law of thermodynamics. Right. And they got that idea because it was used in torpedoes in 1904. And then Tata Motors, it says that they still are doing work on it, at least as of 2017. In February 2017, Dr. Tim Leverton, president and head of at Advanced and Product Engineering at Tata, revealed was at a point of starting industrialization with the first vehicles to be available by 2020. And then you had Engineer, which is the Australian company, who built the engines. They were looking for people too. And then you have Peugeot, Citroën. So they actually have vehicles that will go up to 70 kilometers per hour. But the head of the project left Peugeot in 2014. So they're kind of, you know, at a standstill. And then there's APUQ, which is also French, which is the Association of the Promotion of the Usage of the Quasi-Turbine, which was the APUQ air car. Mm-hmm. I still think that technology is interesting, you know, and what I love about that is that, and what I love about engineering and can always appreciate good engineering is that it's the practical application of physics and chemistry and all the more theoretical sciences. And so it's cool when, you know, somebody takes an idea and goes, well, you know, we do compressed fuel vehicles, why can't we do compressed air or, you know, something else? And I've always wondered, you know, growing up, you heard of the auto or the oil industry, OPEC, you know, some guy, wasn't he also from Ohio, created a car that could split split water into oxygen and hydrogen, and it was super efficient.
Yeah, I don't know if he's from Ohio, but yeah, that's the basis of fuel cells to this day.
Yeah. Some device that you could retrofit onto a gasoline engine.
Called a reformer.
Yeah, and it fit in over, or it fit into the spark plug holes and everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was killed. And we talked about the carbureted, 80 mile per hour carbureted V8. Mm-hmm. And GM in the 80s had developed a motor that had no emissions. It ran off vegetable oil, mm-hmm. but it didn't require, it didn't have an exhaust. And originally developed it for the U.S. Navy because it was like a handheld marine motor that it floated. And so divers and people, if they were escaping ships, they could have them and it would help pull them towards lifeboats or over longer distances than you could expect somebody to reasonably swim. And I don't know that that ever ended up being manufactured either. But, well, I think we've kind of beat this to death. And thank you, Sean, because using your expertise to kind of enlighten us on the industry. Well, I don't want to we could go into your other expertise, which is manufacturing automation. So this is how we make a roller. No, I'm just
exactly.
kidding. But we want to hear from you, our listeners. And please send us video, audio. You know, I won't say snail mail because I don't want snail mail. But text mail to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's GIZMOSAPIENS@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.